Record
Thank
here.
You.
Yeah, welcome
Kinder.
Everybody to.
My conscience is clean.
Yes, it is. It'll be my third copy. House Committee on Judiciary Civil Law. We will begin with a work session on Senate Bill 67. I see we have some amendments in front of us today. Mr. Felton, tell us what they're about.
Well, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, as you remember, how Senate Bill 67 would grant authority to the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court to make by rule regulate the use of electronic applications in the courts. We had a lengthy public hearing on this, and the reason it's back today was that there was some discussion as to the very tail end of the bill, which is the amended language, as to whether it was actually granting a broad authority or a more narrow authority. So Mr. Swank is back here. He has been working with our office to create four amendments. Actually, there are four amendments before. Mr. Swank was involved in three of the amendments, the dash three are the most recent amendments, which grant, we believe, Mr. Swank, I understand, some of the broadest authority to the Chief Justice, and the dash one and twos grant a more narrow authority. Dash four amendments, I believe, came from the Office of Representative Lowe, and so I defer to Mr. Swank and Representative Lowe in regards to all the amendments.
Let's take care of the one, two, and three first. Mr. Swank, if you would tell us what they do.
Chair Shadowley, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Brad Swank. I'm with the State Court Administrator's Office. Council Felton was nice enough after the discussion last time to have three sets of amendments drafted that are progressively less narrow, starting with one, which is the most narrow, and two, which is still pretty narrow, and three, which is actually broader in terms of what the authority of the Chief Justice is to make rules for electronic applications in the courts. And we're actually, after having talked with the Chief, and in light of recent discussions down in Ways and Means Committees of directions they would like to see us head in terms of electronic applications and making things more efficient, we are strong supporters of the Dash 3 amendments, which are the broadest.
Take us through those things.
What it would say is, it says, subject to all other laws governing courts and court procedures, the Chief Justice may make rules for the use of electronic applications in the courts, including but not limited to rules relating to applications based on the use of Internet and other similar technologies, filing electronic documents in court proceedings in lieu of hard copies of those documents. And then the rest reads the same as it does in the current bill. It just makes clear that the applications based on the use of the Internet is not a limiting factor,
sure,
and that the Justice, the Chief, has broad authority to make rules, including but not limited to. So it's broad authority. We expect that we're not likely to abuse this privilege. But
so you've moved in this really the you've moved Internet then from the left side of the colon to the right side of the colon.
Yes.
And hard okay. The language regarding electronic documents in lieu of hard copies is in the bill. Are we just just renumbering that.
That's correct.
Okay, Representative Wibble, you have a question?
Right. I thank you, Mr. Chair. I was just going to make sure, and I have verified it, that the other reasons would continue from the original bill, the payments
right.
and
yes.
so forth.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. Yeah, we're in work session. Yes, okay. Do you want to do that, and then we can take up for number
sure.
four?
Sure.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, I'd just move the adoption of the dash threes.
Okay. Representative Williams moves the adoption of the dash three amendments into Senate Bill 67. Is there any discussion? Any objection? So ordered. Thank you, Mr. Swank. Do you want to hang on for the dash fours? Let's hear about those. You can just from where you are, Representative.
Oh, thank you kindly.
Sure.
Colleagues, this bill had a wide enough relating clause for me to slip this in. What I am proposing is that we, roommate, will you please behave yourself? I'm proposing this. It's a very tiny little thing, but it's a subtle shift of the paradigm, I think. I think that it is a good thing to remind anybody who works for the state of Oregon and who brings a criminal case that they are working for the people of the state of Oregon. This would remind prosecutors, defense attorneys, and judges, as well as jurors, that the decisions that they are making that affect the lives of our citizens, both victims, the public, and defendants, is that what we do in the name of the people of the state of Oregon. This amendment will cost absolutely nothing because it's going to be inserted onto stationery as stationery is renewed, or onto captions.
Word processors, yeah.
On through word processors. Now, I've discussed this with various people, including Representative Mannix, who is supportive of the notion. He said he couldn't come here to testify today because he's just way too busy, and I know that he's got a lot on his plate right now. I've also discussed this with Justice Carson, and he thinks it's a good idea. I've talked to various and sundry prosecutors, people who represent prosecutors, and they all think that it's a fabulous idea. And in fact, a couple of attorneys from the Justice Department and Marla Beam suggested to me that I have legislative counsel find a bill with an appropriate relating clause and slip this in. I have heard absolutely nobody who thinks that this is a bad idea. It's a tiny little idea that could make a big difference in the long run in helping us maintain balance as we try to provide justice for the people of the state of Oregon.
Thank you, Mr. Swank. Do you have some?
Chair Shadow and members of the committee, for the record, again, Brad Swank, State Court Administrator's Office, let me say that we have, I'm going to express concerns about the amendment, not from the viewpoint of the substance of the amendment, which we don't have trouble with, and I've spoken to the Chief Justice about this, and we don't have trouble with the substance of the amendment. We have some concerns about the vehicle. Let me explain why. We think it's reasonably important that there be clear direction in the statute that the Chief Justice has the authority on the electronic applications. In this instance, we are concerned about the potential of a one-subject conflict. And even though the title is broad enough to encompass this, the one-subject rule is actually a different thing than the title. And let me, the current lead case on the one-subject rule is McIntyre versus Forbes, which, as most of you know, was decided in 1996, and it's the site is 322 Oregon 426. And let me read from that, and it will explain our concern. It says, we conclude, and this is the Supreme Court in their opinion, we conclude that the appropriate analysis of a one-subject challenge to the body of a one-subject challenge to the body of the Act made under Article 4, Section 20 should proceed in these steps. One, examine the body of the Act to determine, without regard to examination of the title, whether the court can identify a unifying principle logically connecting all provisions of the Act, such that it can be said that the Act embraces but one subject. And then two, if the court has not identified a unifying principle logically connecting all provisions in the Act, examine the title of the Act with reference to the body of the Act. In a one-subject challenge to the body of the Act, the purpose of that examination is to determine whether the legislature nonetheless has identified and expressed in the title such a unifying principle logically connecting all the provisions in the Act, thereby demonstrating that the Act, in fact, embraces but one subject. In this, in looking at it, our concern was that we couldn't find any logical principle identifying these. As you know, in McIntyre versus Forbes, there were 17 sections of an act that were struck down because they couldn't identify a unifying principle.
Was that relating to government? Wasn't that it?
Relating to good government, I think. And our concern is we would like the authority. We have actually offered a couple of alternatives to Representative Lowe. There is Senate Bill 64 sitting in the Senate Judiciary Committee. I don't know if the chair has any plans for that. It was one of our bills that we've abandoned that also has a title relating to courts, and it's not going anyplace, but it's had a public hearing, so it's still alive. And the other thing that we mentioned to her staff was that this may be an appropriate thing to be approached in the Uniform Trial Court Rules, which, as you know, affects both criminal and civil actions, and there's a process by which that could be sent out and presented to the Uniform Trial Court Rules Committee, and we then send things out for public comment to get public comment back from the members, and that might be an appropriate avenue too. So, as I say, we don't have concerns with the substance, but we are concerned about the vehicle.
Representative Lowe respond, and then Representative Orbelow.
Thank you. I appreciate the concerns that Mr. Swank has raised, and I have in my hand a response to that that was drafted by David Hendricks, Deputy Legislative Counsel, that speaks directly to the concerns that he brought up. And I do think that if you review this, you will find that this is an appropriate vehicle. It was selected.
Copies for us?
Yes, I do. It was selected, thank you, because this bill is going somewhere and the others aren't.
Representative Wilbon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. With all due respect to Representative Lowe, I guess I'll be the first one that says I don't like this bill. And the reason why, this may surprise some of my colleagues,
the bill
but
or the amendment.
In some manners I'm very traditionalist.
The amendment? You mean the amendment?
The amendment,
yeah,
I'm sorry.
Dash four.
I am rather conservative, especially when it comes to tradition, and when tradition is not broken, which it is not, the way we use it now, our headings. And I know it was stated well. What this will do is tell all those people, the prosecutors, the courts, and so forth, we keep reminding them who they represent. Well, if they don't know now who they represent, they shouldn't be in those roles. And I don't think we have to keep reminding them, because I think they do know. I did hear Ms. Swank, I think, make a suggestion that I do like. If we want to consider this, I would also think sending it to the Council on Court Procedures or something like that, where you can get input and discussion and so forth, would be the proper way to go. But I can't focus.
May I respond? Thank you. Respectfully to Representative Orbelow, I do know prosecutors who believe that they represent only the victims and who see themselves in the role of avenging angels instead of representing all of the people of the state of Oregon, including the defendants. I think that advocacy on the behalf of prosecutors should, it is appropriate to remind them that they represent all of the people of the state of Oregon. And sometimes young, vibrant, brand new prosecutors need that reminder.
I would just respond.
Sure.
I agree with you. I do think there are prosecutors out there who think they represent only the victims. However, some of those are not the young, vibrant. Some of those have been around for a long time, and it's their orientation. And I don't care what we put up at the top, they're not going to change their orientation, because I think underneath they're very well aware they should be representing all the people. It's just the way they think philosophically, and I don't think this can change that.
Couldn't hurt.
in civil actions, I understand the rationale in criminal actions. I see this as in any civil action as well. We have state ex rel proceedings. How would that affect the caption of an ex rel proceeding?
I think that it very easily could be put people of the state of Oregon ex rel, thus and so, or in child support prosecutions, for example, there are a lot of civil things that happen, but the state takes a role. So, I don't know. I think it's an easy thing to do. It's a very easy thing to do. Costs nothing.
Well, we've got a couple options. We're in work session. We could move. Somebody could make a motion, or we'll just close the work session and either put the thing in. I guess if it goes in, and I'm willing to let the committee vote to do or not do that. This is going to have to go back to the Senate for concurrence anyway, and that would allow some time to flesh out the. One subject issue, they could always vote to not concur and take it out in a conference committee if that's a problem. Or if the committee's preference would be to defer to Mr. Swank's suggestion that this be referred or at least examined by the Council on Court Procedures and then have maybe some broader input in a hearing process. I don't know. I tell you, committee, I'm not driving this one way
Mr.
or another.
Chairman.
Maybe you could tell that. Representative.
Well, you know, in view of the fact that we have an opinion here from Legislative Council, I'm comfortable with it, and I would move the adoption of the dash four amendments into the bill.
We're moving. Representative Williams.
Mr. Chairman, I would just speak in support of Representative Wood's motion. I do think, quite frankly, that the Council on Court Procedures would be the wrong people to consider this issue. I think, you know, they're primarily involved with the rules of civil procedure, and I think this is a broader policy issue that is appropriate for this body to make one way or the other, and we can all have our own opinion about it. But I think this is the body that ought to make the determination as to how the state of Oregon presents itself in the caption of both criminal and civil proceedings. So I spoke my piece.
Okay. Anybody else? I guess this is one, thank you, Mr. Swink. This is one where I suppose the likelihood of a challenge is remote. And secondly, it will be the Supreme Court reviewing their own bill to determine whether it stands or not. with electronic application built into it, that would be interesting.
Mr. Chairman?
Representative Witt.
Yeah, I think it is, the language is significant, and I think it does properly and directly does designate who is the party in interest.
Okay.
And because of that, I think it's, frankly, it's a truth in labeling act almost. It makes it clear and specific as to who's being represented here.
Okay. Well, I think I get a sense of this. Let's go ahead. We have the motion before us is to adopt the dash four amendments into Senate Bill 67. I'll ask for the record, is there any objection?
Yes.
Of one, Representative Werbel. Is there any other objection to the dash four amendments? So ordered, with one objection, that being Representative Werbelow's. Now we have before us then the bill as amended by the dash three and the dash four amendments.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Williams.
I would move Senate Bill 67 to the floor with a due pass recommendation as amended.
Representative Williams moves Senate Bill 67 as amended by the dash three and dash four amendments to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion on the motion? Hearing none, please call the roll.
Representative Batson?
Aye.
Representative Edwards?
Excuse?
Representative
Bush? Aye.
Representative
Herbalow?
Yes. Representative
Walker?
Aye.
Representative
Williams?
Aye.
Representative
Webb?
Aye.
Chair
Sedgley? Aye. Bill 67 goes to the floor with the due pass recommendation. Representative Lowe, do you want to carry that?
I'd be honored to.
Right.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Okay, that concludes the work session on Senate Bill 67. Next, let's move into public hearing on House Bill 3304. Council.
Mr. Chairman, House Bill 3304 authorizing impoundment of a vehicle operated by a person arrested or issued a citation for driving while under the influence of intoxicants or for criminal driving while suspended if the suspension resulted from driving while under the influence of intoxicants. Mr. Chairman.
Can I do it from here?
Yeah, you can do it from here, too. You bet.
Thank you. House Bill 3304 is, I'm the sponsor of it, along with some other who have joined in. There is actually a work group looking at this right now, the state police, some local governments and local police and tow companies and people who would be involved if this were passed. And the concerns are being raised, and we're going to have some amendments. So at this point, I would ask the committee to wait till this work group has finished their work, so to speak.
Okay. Nobody has signed up to testify on that.
We told everybody.
Yeah, okay. Just want to make sure there wasn't anybody here that dropped in from out of the blue. Representative Wells, do you want to mention your issue with this, since it may be something for the work group to consider?
Oh, good, yes.
Yes. Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. I've been working on an issue relating to this 809, Chapter 809, and this was, of course, put together. It deals with impoundment of vehicles without, this is 809-720, and the reason cities can impound vehicles. And I had a constituent that got a hold of me because their driver's license had expired. And they had not realized it. The city of Kaiser picked them up, left him, he and his kids, standing beside the road, and took their car. and they did give the car back when they realized that really that they shouldn't have been doing that. But in the statute, it allows this for cities to do this, operating without driving privileges. And I spoke with Kelly Taylor about this issue, and basically, as it would be understood, if their license had expired, regardless of only one day or 2 days, they really don't have driving privileges under current law. Mm-hmm. And this statute really addresses the fact that these people are driving suspended or they are driving under the influence and toxins. You know, they've really committed a crime. And there was a suggestion from my constituent that we allow some type of a grace period or something. Of course, I know they allow a grace period of 30 days, well, then they can still go over the grace period. But this issue is it seems like it's gone a little bit too far. And I think maybe the work group that worked on this issue last session may have addressed this, but that really is the issue I've kind of looked at in behalf of my constituent, is whether we need to look at 720C, which is operating without driving privileges or in violation of license restrictions in violation of ORS 87, whether
that merits impoundment.
An issue will allow an impoundment of your vehicle because you let your driver's license expire and had not realized it. And I guess that's kind of my issue here.
I would just respond. 3304 really addresses the issue of somebody who's driving while under the influence and criminal driving while suspended or revoked. So it's a little different than what you're talking to. But are what you're asking is that we look at that too and perhaps incorporate it into the bill?
Yes, Mr. Chair, because it amends Chapter 809.
Right.
Dealing with allowing impoundments because of relating driving offenses.
I think, my understanding, he sees wants to seize this vehicle for the purpose of an amendment.
I'll be glad to consider that. We've been working, both Deschutes County and in the Portland area, Multnomah County, have a program that they have actually set up themselves based on similar. It addresses, I think Portland addresses prostitutes, but also could look to do similar things. And so that's where the group that's working together, and I'll sure bring that up, that makes some sense, and see how if they think it would work. I look to them for their, how they deal with these things on the street, so to speak, and if it would create any problem, but it seems like certain companies.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, as I understand the issue, of course, it really is up to the cities. They're making those decisions on what they want to impound for, and we may have some police people out there that maybe get a little too aggressive to be impounding vehicles because a guy's driver's license expired.
Right. Yeah, really. This bill really is more focusing on a forfeiture, but we had to do the impoundment first kind of as a warning type of thing. But certainly I've made a note and we'll consider that.
I guess I do. I would have the question,
That back to me.
We have here 809.720 that does authorize impoundment in this case for, as you said, driving without privileges or in violation of license restrictions, but also impoundment for driving while suspended and driving under the influence of intoxicants.
Right.
Does this bill amend that statute?
Well, what it does...
Because it begins with impoundment.
And then moves to forfeiture.
Yeah, and I'm just wondering, do we want this side by side with an existing impoundment statute, or should we amend 720 to begin with?
This is what legislative council, and we are looking at those issues.
Because you would then have two impoundment statutes operating side by side. Okay. That's fine. Anything else to comment in here? I just had a question, Representative Werbelow, just on line 22, and the work group will work this out. But what's a rural area?
Well, we all knew what it was when we were talking about it, but you're right. It's not. We were mainly thinking about Eastern Oregon in those areas where there's no public transportation. So if you took a car away, you could be leaving families in a world of hurt, if they couldn't get to work and so forth. And so we were making an exception, and perhaps we do need to define
it. Well, you see, because when I read that, that raised my, because in my district, Dallas, I don't know if you'd call that a rural area. I know from Portland you might, some of you would, but In Dallas, we don't consider a rural area, but there's no public, there's no public transportation, let alone convenient.
I'd live in Dallas, Mr. Chair, and call it rural.
Yeah, Mr. Chair.
I've never been there, so it must be rural.
There was it. Well,
thank you. We had this issue last session,
yeah.
And we had a hearing on it. And you know, as I remember, the big issue was the holding this impounded car for almost a year from the time it's picked up until conviction, because they can't forfeit until conviction. And that really caused a real problem, a real expense. And we didn't go anywhere with this issue last time because of that,
yeah,
that issue.
Actually, we came close, Representative, but the really big issue was the state police saying they weren't sure. They don't have impoundment lots. And we were extending this to the whole state, so the state police would be very involved in this. And they saw this as a tremendous financial burden. So we decided that we would all talk about this and work, because they liked the idea, but they needed to, especially since we have underfunded the state police in the last, at least some of the things we have, that we needed to take that into consideration and deal with that issue. And so that's one of the things we're working on.
I think one of the other issues, just for the work group, but we're kind of treading water here until Representative Wilkin gets here for her bill, but also I think one that we were concerned about last time was the effect of the impoundment on other members of the family who may have an immediate need for perhaps just the one vehicle, either for employment or other, you know, other necessity, and the question of how much time does it take to get it released, what kind of, what's the process there.
And one of the ideas we came up with, the rural area, knowing, you know, that they could get it back right away, and then some other things. So we're working on all those.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, what are we doing about the security interest? Because that was, they figured probably isn't hardly any automobiles out there that don't have a security interest. How are you going to deal with that?
Well, it wouldn't be any different than right now. There's forfeiture, criminal forfeiture, civil forfeiture if your vehicle is tied in some way to criminal acts. And the lien holder, the security interest, always has priority. You cannot affect that. So if you forfeit a vehicle and you sell it, the off the top has to go to the lien holder. They have priority.
But Mr. Chair, it could be impounded for a year before you get conviction.
We
you
don't
can't get through the courts.
We don't contemplate impoundment for a year. I don't even remember that in the old one, but
I guess they were just theorizing how quickly this was going to go through the court before you had settlement of this issue and had conviction. Before then, it's all settled. In the meantime, it's sitting in an impoundment lot, and who's protecting the asset and that sort of thing.
Okay, let's go ahead and close this. We've got one more bill we can take out of order that probably won't take too long. But thank you for bringing that forward today. Close the public hearing on House Bill 3304. Let's take up House Bill 3576. I'll open the public hearing on that. We don't have a staff measure summary on that. Council, do you want to read the bill for us and tell us what...
I apologize, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for not getting you a measure summary out there. But on review of the bill, as you see, it is making an amendment to the public records laws, which would allow that records related to a public utility's purchase or sale of electric power services would be, and also their customers, would be exempt from the public records law. As you see within the statute and the bill, there's a whole laundry list of items which are exempted from that law. This would add another one to it. And in this era of private and public utilities and competitive business, there's some background related to competitive involvement in the market for the public utilities. And I'll stop there and allow the sponsors to give a more distinct background. And there's also a -1 amendment before you.
I don't see one. Does anybody else have a -1?
Yes.
Okay. Go ahead. We'll still keep looking, but thank you.
There should be a staple -1 with a hand engrossed copy of the bill.
Well, I'm looking for mine. Let's bring up who we have here. Diane Cowan and Tom O'Connor.
One minute. Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I am Diane Callen, the Executive Director of the Oregon People's Utility District Association. With me today is Tom O'Connor. Tom represents the Oregon Municipal Electric Utilities. We appreciate the opportunity to speak in favor of House Bill 3576 today. This bill proposes two changes to the public records law, as the committee council said. The first one pertains to our utilities' purchases or sales of electric power or services, and the second change refers to customer information that's held by our utilities. I'll discuss the power sales portion, and Tom will speak to the consumer information fees. Both of these proposed changes bring the PUDs and municipal electric utilities in line with how these issues are currently handled for investor-owned utilities and the cooperatives in our state. The Dash 1 amendments to 3576 tightens the language to specifically deal with PUDs and municipal electric utilities. You'll see the hand in gross there. Lines 12 and 13 would read, information that if disclosed would adversely affect the purchase or sale of electric power or services by a people's utility district or municipally owned electric utility, public agency or public body was much broader than our intention. As you're well aware, things are changing in our industry. Oregon PUDs and munis have historically purchased all of their energy supply, 100%, from the Bonneville Power Administration. But with the Federal Act, Energy Act of 1992, and the expiration of our 20-year contracts with Bonneville expiring in June and October of 2001, our community-owned utilities are going to be able to have the opportunity to purchase some or all of their wholesale energy requirements on the open market. We're hopeful that energy providers will be in competition for this business. We may even end up being in competition trying to get the supply. But consequently, there will be a definite and growing need for the public bodies to be able to keep the terms and pricing of these purchase arrangements confidential. On the flip side, too, our larger customers are interested in negotiating for best price and terms on their contracts that they have with us, and this language would protect that language, that whatever arrangements we make with them, to be held back from competitors taking a look at what kind of deals they're making, so it would protect those customers also. So unless you have questions regarding this section of the bill, Tom will explain the need for sub 26.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, Tom O'Connor with Oregon Municipal Electric Utilities. As Diane mentioned, the second part of the bill deals with the confidentiality of our of the information that is provided to us by our customers, and I attached, along with the map there for Oregon Municipal Electric Utilities, I attached a sample bill from one of our members. The last page of that shows the kinds of some of the kinds of information that we have as part of our customer records, of course, including name and address, phone numbers. And in a number of cases, sometimes those are unlisted numbers that people leave with us for emergency purposes, but they would be unlisted otherwise. We also have credit ratings, information about the person's past payment records, in some cases information about who to call in case of emergencies, and that type of thing. We have actually over the years assumed that this information was generally confidential, and that the customer could keep it confidential if they wanted. In recent years, we've found that not to be true. In looking at this issue, having several of the utilities having inquiries about customers or seeking access to all the bills in a given community, we reviewed the Public Records Act, and it was pretty clear to us that there was no exemption for these kinds, for this kind of information. And unlike, as Diane said, the private utilities and the cooperatives or ports, for example, that are in 192, and so. This section is drafted to say that that information would not be released unless the customers consent, or that it's part of the information that we need to run the electric utility, or to deal with credit and collection, because sometimes we do use third-party collection. And that's the purpose of the second part of the language.
Okay. Questions of either of these two? Then let's hear the other side of the story. Lori Brocker is here to testify as well. If you want to stay there, it's fine with me. We may generate some discussion here back and forth. Ms. Brocker, what do you want to say about my bill?
I was going to say, with all due respect to the sponsor, we oppose. For the record, I'm Lori Brocker, General Counsel for Oregon Newspaper Publishers Association. And we are in opposition to the bill, although appreciate the parties that have testified narrowing the portion that they did, because that was one of the issues that I raised in testimony. I won't read through this, but want to highlight a couple points. OMPA generally has concerns about the continued piecemeal erosion of the public records law, and this session is no different, and that doesn't mean that there aren't justifications for adding to the list of exemptions, but we have concerns that these requests be scrutinized closely, and also raise some specific issues about this particular provision. Initially, we were concerned about it being too broadly drafted, and still actually are. The Attorney General in the decades since the public records law was enacted has consistently indicated that the presumption of the public records law is that there is an openness. And then the presumption continues in that any exemption should be narrowly tailored and narrowly construed as it is applied. And our concern with the wording of HB 3576 is that isn't necessarily the case, neither in that it was narrowly tailored, and because of that could be quite broadly construed. So that was one of the specific concerns. We also have a concern about the consistent placement of these exemptions in ORS 192502, which provides an absolute exemption in contrast to ORS 192501, which at least, and this is certainly not our preference, but at the very least allows for a balancing test of the public interest. It's very rare when those requests are made to either on the local level, a district attorney, or the attorney general on the state agency level. It's very rare that they are granted, and as the general counsel for the newspaper publishers, it's been my experience to often be denied those records when those requests are made. But nonetheless, the placement in 501 at least allows for the recognition that there is and or may be in a particular instance a public interest that should be considered. With that, I will also, I also wanted to just note, I saw today in the bills as I was reviewing A. N. Groh's Senate Bill 1149, and I don't know if this committee is familiar with that, but there's a lot of language, and maybe these people can speak to that, a lot of similar language in 1149, excuse me, over in the Senate, with their provisions are numbered because these aren't consistent until we get all the other exemptions that relate to other issues. So they are also numbering at 25 and 26 under 502, and it has some of the same purpose, I believe, and a lot of the same language. So I raise that as an issue as well.
Okay. Let's see. Representative Williams has a question. Then, if you want to respond to the 1149,
Ms. Brocker, I guess I'm just interested in your I recognize why the Oregon Newspaper Publishers Association would consider any erosion of the public records law to be a concern to you. But in a situation where we're likely heading towards deregulation of the industry, do you think it's fair for these public utility organizations to not have their customer lists and the information that they have about the people who are using their services somewhat protected, just like a private industry frankly would or does?
Well, Mr. Chair and Representative Williams, on one hand, as a citizen who is part of that and just in privacy issues, I do understand that. On the other hand, there are some trade-offs that we have in a system of open government. And I start with the premise that the government's business is your business and is my business. And while there are reasons, and I grant you that you have raised one of them, that people may differ on what should be exempt from the public records law and what should not be, I err on the side of openness and the presumption of openness and recognizing that at some time I may lose or there may be some negative consequences in the sense of taxpayer cost for that may arise with deregulation issues. So I understand the concern. On the other hand, I think that I can speak for the newspaper publishers and also simply as a person who is proud of the premise of democracy, to not be melodramatic, that presumes open government and presumes that the public utility business is our business.
Tom, or do you want to address the question about Senate Bill? I'm sorry. Well, let's get that response before we get too far removed from the issue. 1149.
Mr. Chair, yes, the language, the similar language is in Senate Bill 1149, which is the major deregulation bill that is currently under consideration in the Senate.
I see why you wanted a separate vehicle.
That's part of the reason, and also because, as we said, these issues have arisen for us prior to the deregulation piece of this. On the one hand, with the contracts and so on, with wholesale deregulation at the federal level, and the problem with our customer list has arisen, as I say, independent of deregulation.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to add that the PUDs, and I speak only for them, but I'm sure that the unis, Tom, would echo this, have been extremely respectful of the public records and open meetings laws of the state. I've been representing them now for 10 years, and we've never been before a committee before asking for this. This is certainly not a trend. It's because our industry is changing, and we feel this is something that's necessary to protect our customers.
Okay. Representative Warbler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I wanted to ask if it appeared that this bill was going to pass, Tom, would you have any problem with placing it, making that change in placement so there was the opportunity for a balancing test?
Before you answer, I've got to leave it. We've got a meeting down in the Senate at 2:00. But before you answer, Ms. Brocker knows full well that Senator Bryan has already done that to a public records exemption that I had over that passed out of the House under 502, got to the Senate, and he moved it into 501, and we just concurred on it. So it seems to be at least his predilection to do that on the Senate side. Maybe comment on that, because it's a fair question.
But I'd like to know how they feel, how that would affect.
Mr. Chair, Representative Werbelow, I am not an attorney, and I guess all I ask is that we get a chance to look at that.
502, the bill that it's in now is an absolute, no questions asked exemption. 501 creates a balancing, or not a balancing, but it's a presumption of exclusion from public records, or unless what's the showing that has to be made?
A request needs to be made to on the local level, it's to a district attorney, and on the state level, it's to the attorney general. So there still is a presumption that it is exempt, but it does allow it for the list of exemptions. It says that the public interest may be considered for possible disclosure in a particular instance. And that showing has to be made, and the decision is made by the DA or the Attorney General.
Mr. Chair, if I may, the reason, I mean, we chose this particular section, Representative Werbelow, is that part of this was modeled on the exemption that the legislature granted to the Oregon Health Sciences University a couple of years ago for their transactions. And then I think I'm right about the ports customer list being in the same section. I may be wrong, but we'd certainly take a look at that.
Further questions? Hearing none, why don't we... I guess I'd ask you both from the municipal folks and the PUD to work with Mr. Felton if you in fact believe that there needs to be or you're willing to entertain that amendment. And then I think at that point we'll have a conversation with the chairman. And but I don't think we're going to, or I don't think we're prepared necessarily to move the bill today. Does this sound all right? Anybody else have any questions?
Thank you for your time.
Oh, sorry, Representative Backlund, I didn't see your fingers there.
I just raised them at the very last moment.
Okay.
Kind of an editorial, I guess. I think we all would admire the concept and the intent of the public records law. And I note in Mrs. Brocker's second paragraph, I guess, her concern about the continued piecemeal erosion of the public records law. I guess if we do have exemptions as we go on down the road, I guess I would hope that it would be on a piecemeal basis rather than some broad possible loss of the public access. So I guess I too would be interested in this in the 501 approach, which would be much more narrow, I think.
That's
all I can gather anyway.
Representative Witt.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I also want to editorialize for a minute. In view of the fact that this whole industry is very quickly here subject to deregulation, being able to protect certain information becomes competitively necessary. And it seems to me that if publicly owned utilities are going to be able to be allowed to be competing on an even playing field as we move into the future, they need to have the same kind of confidentiality protections that investor-owned utilities have. If they don't have that, they simply are put at a significant disadvantage in the marketplace. Over and beyond that, some of this information, particularly as it relates to customers and how customers pay their bills and what services they use, those things should not be publicly available. They should be confidential just by their very nature. So appreciate you bringing this bill. I think it's a good bill.
I have a question, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Lowe.
Thank you kindly, Mr. Chairman. It seems to me I remember from my days as a prosecutor the police having access to these utility records to help them establish probable cause for, you know, like finding a grow operation or, you know, if something's out of whack with the record. Is there anything in what you are proposing that would limit or restrict that?
Mr. Chair, Representative Lowe, good question. I had the same one. In the language that we submitted to Legislative Council, the other exception to or instance where the material could be released was pursuant to a court order. And that Leg Council told us that we didn't need to put that in, that that was a given. And that's all. That's what we were told by Leg Council.
Actually, I'm not inquiring about court order circumstances. I'm talking about that stage at which when they're attempting to establish probable cause or a reasonable suspicion, which is precursor to them getting any kind of a search warrant. So if you close this off, they may not have informal access to those records, and I'm a little worried about that.
Mr. Chair, Representative Lowe, that certainly is not the intent, because I know the utilities do cooperate with the law enforcement when they have a meter reading that's all of a sudden much higher. You know, that certainly can indicate that there's some sort of an illegal operation. That's not
or
the
a
intent.
New baby born to the household, or
right.
You know, whatever.
That's yeah. Certainly not the intent. We'd be happy to take a look and see if that would stop them from continuing that information.
Yeah, I would appreciate knowing if this is going to damage a valuable tool. So,
Ms. Brocker, you wish to comment on that?
Mr. Chair, and Representative Witt and Representative Lowe, in connection to this most recent discussion, I think one of the things that is in my testimony or alluded to in the testimony, written testimony, that I didn't talk about is that it's our belief that there are some provisions already in place that would protect proprietary information, sensitive business information, even for a public body, and also that there are provisions that protect particular addresses and names for people, particularly if they request them. There's a standard exemption if people would like that information to be exempt from any kind of disclosure. So there are some things in place that already protect this kind of information. And Representative Lowe, you raise one of many points that we have concerns about when you reference the law enforcement. A lot of times, well-intentioned exemptions to the public records law have negative consequences or potential negative consequences for the public. So we just urge consideration of this. Certainly we urge the placement of it in 501 so that in particular instances, like what you mentioned or even a more broader exemption for that part, that at least some of this information could be before an attorney general or a district attorney and they could make a balancing determination.
Good. Members of the committee, any further questions?
I think we're done.
I asked that once before, and then no problem. I'll close the public hearing.
Thank you for your time.
Thank you.
Before I did that, I should have asked, was there anybody else here that wanted to testify on that bill? Okay, I didn't think so. Representative Loken, are you here? There you are. I'm sorry, I didn't even see you there. We will now open a public hearing on House Bill 3462. And once again, it's our distinguished pleasure to have Representative Loken with us again today.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm surprised that some of these bills that I've introduced just all of a sudden come together on just within a few days. It is my pleasure to be here, and I'm representative, for the record, Jane Loken from District 25. This bill, HB 3468 or 62, is a bill that addresses something that's really become a terrible reality in every corner of Oregon, I am surprised to find, and that is drive-by shootings. The letter that you have is from a young man that was actually my campaign manager and whom I became very good friends with, and he suggested this bill. He came from the small town of Milton Freewater, and you wouldn't think, of drive-by shootings in Milton Freewater, but you can see from his letter that it's even there, and I think I might have given away my last copy I did. Even there, they live in fear of these same types of attacks. It is a sad thing when in a small town like that, you have to have this type of criminal action. And of course, where I live, I certainly live near Portland areas that are terrorized, literally, with drive-by shootings. And this bill provides a specific definition. It includes many types of crimes that are committed through this. It actually describes what a drive-by shooting means, and they are listed in the bill. It's discharge of a firearm from a motor vehicle while committing or attempting to commit the series of offenses listed in the bill. I'd like you to consider how the use of a vehicle changes the scope and the nature of this serious crime. The shooter's target could be a person, a victim, standing in front of his home or gathered outside of a business. It could even be just the home, hoping to hit somebody inside. Could be at a school, could be at a business, or the target could be another motorist, and we've read about these things. In any case, the drive-by shooter enjoys the freedom of a car to make his escape. He's in the car, he's moving, and he can use a deadly weapon from that car, and in essence, the car itself becomes a deadly weapon as a result. And of course, if he hits another motorist, you have another problem in that if the driver is injured, the car can run into another car, injure other motorists, injure other property, And so it's a very desperate situation. And what's hit sometimes is not the intended target. Lieutenant Masig, and I'm not quite sure how he pronounced that name, he said it so fast, Portland Police Department, Gang Enforcement Unit. And he said that in some Portland neighborhoods, families are actually seeking protection by sleeping in their bathtubs at night. Can you believe that? It's really frightening. But they see the most law enforcement officials see these drive-by shootings, stating again from the lieutenant, as gang-related activities. And he said in the city of Portland, largely because of bad weather so far this year, the number of drive-by shootings is low, only one a week. Can you believe? One a week. That's a lot of drive-by shootings. But in good weather, two shootings a night is not unusual. While it's difficult to apprehend the shooters, the Portland Gang Enforcement Unit, with cooperation from the district attorney, is able to confiscate between, or is able to apprehend between 5% and 10% of the vehicles, of, or would be able to apprehend these vehicles and their drivers, and they hope, of course, to increase that. It's not easy to catch them, but these are drive-by shooting people. And so that's the frightening thing. I feel that by taking away the vehicle from a drive-by shooter, as well as having him apprehended and receiving the punishment that is due him that the court decides upon, that I think it would send an additional message if they lost the car from which the drive-by shooting occurred. Any proceeds from the sale of a car, my bill directs to educational programs concerning the use of guns and gun safety. Now, I'm open to a suggestion on that. In fact, I have another one to make. I've talked with some others and talked with the lieutenant about this, and I would be, and perhaps my preference would be to make that those forfeiture funds go to victims assistance. And Lieutenant McHigg said that any local jurisdiction, police jurisdiction, would have appropriate recipients of those funds. So I hope that the committee will view this as a worthwhile bill, and that you would be able to move it. Open to any questions.
Thank you, Representative. Any questions for Representative Loken? Representative Ubelin.
It's not specifically a Representative Loken. Do we have anybody from law enforcement here to testify? No. Oh, well, then I can ask the question. Is does our present existing forfeiture laws, when a vehicle or mass that is tied to a crime, they can't be used in this situation?
Why don't we bring the gentleman up and have him put his name on the record?
For the record, I'm Sergeant Alan Hagen, the Oregon State Police. The state policeman that's actually monitoring this bill is Larry Welty. He's not able to be here, so I'm here in his stead. And could you repeat the question? I'm sorry.
We now have existing forfeiture laws where if the vehicle, for example, is involved in a drug type of thing, we can forfeit. Is that law not broad enough? Since this is a crime, a drive-by shooting is a crime, does not the existing law cover something like this as to forfeiture? Do you know?
Chair Williams, Representative Uberall, I don't know. That's something I have to find out.
We have one other person who... Well, let's make this a broad-based discussion.
My name is Karen Holton, and I staff the Asset Forfeiture Oversight Advisory Committee. And the current forfeiture law... it's very specific in the illegal activity that can take place, and it must be drug-related for that to be covered under the current law. So the drive-by shooting would not be covered.
If I could ask then, Karen, what, unless there was some what's the word I'm looking for, some other activity taking place within the vehicle. In other words, if they were able to stop the vehicle that was used in a drive-by shooting and within the vehicle there was drug activity, they could seize it under the basis of the
right.
drug law, but if they pulled the vehicle over and in fact there were no drugs in the vehicle, just young men with guns, that would not be enough under the current law in order
right.
to
right.
take the vehicle under forfeiture.
Correct.
Okay, good. Thank you. Representative Lowe.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Wilkin, I was trying to do some cross-referencing of your bill, which I like it well, and I ran across some other language in 166-220, and I was wondering if you had given any thought or thought it might be advisable or perhaps reject the notion of expanding the scope of the bill to include not only firearms, but discharges from blowguns, bow and arrows, crossbows, and including explosive devices that are thrown out with the intent.
I would certainly be willing to amend my bill to include that. That is not covered by current law.
Actually, not like that.
maybe I might ask the representative from the state police, and he may or may not know this, but Sergeant, do you know the last time we maybe had a crossbow shooting or a blowgun shooting in a drive-by shooting sort of scenario?
Vice Chair Williams, no, I don't know of either one of those. We've had some unusual weapons used. Pellet guns are real frequent, and there's been some other unique type of homemade weapons and stuff used. I couldn't specifically recall any of those two.
Haven't you ever seen Dukes of Hazzard?
Oh, I think we're declining yeah. rapidly here. Sergeant, is a pellet gun, though,
on a roll today,
considered a firearm or an unlawful weapon under the definition of the statute? Do you know that?
I'd have to look that up, Chair Williams.
Okay.
I'm not sure.
Okay. Representative Witt.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, I'm being a little bit too sensitive to this, but if you look at the language of line 4, section 1, a motor vehicle used by or with the knowledge of the owner in a drive-by shooting, well, knowledge doesn't necessarily imply consent. And I think the intention of this is being used with the knowledge and consent of the owner.
Mm-hmm. I think that's an excellent point.
And Mr. Chairman, I might add, with the knowledge and consent of the owner that the car is going to be used for a drive-by shooting, or just that it's being used with the knowledge and the consent of the owner. I think we've got to be careful here on our language.
Yeah, I mean, you could certainly envision a situation, Representative Witt, where you see your car being driven out of a mall parking lot while you're standing on the steps. You certainly now have knowledge, but not necessarily consent that there's use of that vehicle. Representative Wells.
Yeah, thank you. It's nice to see Karen here. I serve on the Civil Forfeiture Asset Oversight Committee, and it's been an interesting experience this past year. And as you well know, this is a real controversial law that we have, allowing taking of possessions without conviction of a crime. Civilly, we take them. And maybe Karen could do a better job than me, but maybe review for the committee the reasoning of why we do it for drug issues and currently not for anything else. Or am I putting you on the spot, Karen?
You are definitely putting me on the spot because I was here just to monitor what was going on.
Oh.
I was not here to testify in any way.
I think it deals a little with the fact of the profits of the drug trade.
Right, and that a lot of times, by taking that property away from them, you're also taking away their ability to trade in the drug market as well. And that is why.
Yes, Mr. Chair, I think, you know, it seems to be the issue there that the profits are made in the drug trade, and we're not only seizing the drugs themselves when we catch these people, we're seizing the cars, they haul them in, or maybe we're seizing the cash, we're seizing the guns, we're seizing kind of everything. It's all kind of tied together because it was made, those items were made through the profit of drugs, and so we're trying to take that away. Second thing that makes civil commitment really controversial is that the arresting agency gets to keep those goods to go into their budget. and it doesn't necessarily go through the general fund. They keep it right into their budget in many cases. So that is real controversial, that there might be incentives for the police to do civil forfeiture. And it's been an interesting experience to deal with this whole section of the law of civil forfeiture, and so to expand it into an area here of taking property for a different reason. I don't know whether I've decided how I really feel about this, but I think it's something we need to look at very closely, how far we're going to expand this issue.
Chair.
Representative Ubelin.
Yeah, I just want to say, I think statistically, if you looked at most drive-by shootings are related to drug traffic. They may not be delivering drugs at that time, but there has been some contention between different factions. The other thing, too, is you mentioned that one of the reasons that the vehicle in the drug world is so important, because that's how you deliver them. Well, you can't have a drive-by shooting by just definition without the car to drive by. And so there is that relationship. The third point I was going to make is one thing that we've worked with the state police and other police forces on these, my particular bill, we have found, or at least we've been told, and I assume people are telling us the truth, these are not cash cows. And in fact, as many of the vehicles that are picked up are what we know as beaters or old. And in fact, as you can take a loss once, for example, you impound them or put them on a yard. And these people, if they're going to lose their car, walk away from it. And so there's towing charges and other type of thing that somebody has to absorb. They're not getting the 1999 Cadillacs, which certainly could bring in some money. So, yeah, those are all issues we need to think about, but I at least what we've heard on our bill, I'm not sure that they are a huge concern, although taking somebody's property in the first place is a concern, so we should be careful how we do that.
Well, committee, I guess I would just say Representative Loken, who proposed an amendment on her own, which would direct any proceeds from the forfeiture towards the Victims Assistance Fund. I think that's an amendment that perhaps she or council could work on getting. I think Representative Witt's point is an excellent one, ensuring that we have some sort of a consent portion tied into the knowledge piece.
Good idea.
And so we probably ought to bring it back. Representative Lowe has been good to hand me a note telling me that there was a case in Clackamas County involving road rage where people shot bows and arrows at each other from cars.
Well, it was one car into another, and I think do you remember that case, Jane? I think
no,
it actually hurt somebody.
And to point out Representative Ubelau's comment, you can't have a drive-by shooting without a car. You could do it on a bike. So maybe we ought to have it for people shooting bows and arrows on bikes. But I do think that there are some amendments that we really ought to consider with the bill. But in general, I think that my personal view is that this is probably a good idea. And Representative Wells.
Yes, thank you. Maybe we have Karen can talk about this. We have forfeiture councils that are set up to oversee agencies who do forfeiting. How would this fit in with the paperwork that we've been putting together for those forfeiture councils, and would this come under their purview, a thing like this?
It would depend if it fell under 475A. If it falls under the reporting requirements of 475A, then agencies who were seizing and forfeiting vehicles for drive-by shootings would then fall under the reporting requirement to the Asset Forfeiture Oversight Committee. The question would then arise of whether any share of those proceeds would then fall into the requirements of contribution to DEQ for drug lab cleanup and contribution to AFOC for staff funding.
Yes, that could cause a little conflict because this isn't dealing with drugs, and part of the proceeds currently from forfeitures goes to fund the Asset Oversight Committee, which we have a bill in to deal with that issue, expanding the revenue to the committee. But some of that money does go to DEQ and that sort of thing to clean up drug labs. So whether we're expecting money from cars that's going into the fund to clean up drug labs under DEQ, under current, if it went into that statute.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Representative Wilkins.
I'd be happy to work with both of the people here to, and with Legislative Council to make some appropriate amendments. I might add, too, that the idea of forfeiture, I don't know, I guess we're all very much aware of that, and even on a federal level, and sponsored a bill last session at the suggestion of a gentleman that was knowledgeable about this through his work in the National Guard for some reason, and as a result, Oregon is getting some money soon, or else they already have it, from a federal fund on forfeitures. So there seems, even though some of this, and I recognize Representative Below's comments as certainly being true, I would think that some of these cars are probably stolen. But on the other hand, I believe, too, that some of these people own their own cars and do have some value in them. And if they lose them, they're not going to be so apt to try the same thing again. And it's a deterrent. It's just one more deterrent that we keep putting out there to try to curb the crime that we see today.
Good. Thank you, Representative Logan. Colleagues, you'll remember that we had a bill not long ago that dealt with the whole issue of forfeiture and the standard. The chair assigned me to work in excuse me?
2610.
I think, yeah, that is the bill number. Assigned me to work in a work group, and that bill will be coming back, I believe, at some point here in the relatively near future. Hopefully we could schedule it on a day and could bring 3462 back with the amendments that Representative Logan would like to offer at that time, and we can have another forfeiture day here on committee. Or we could forfeit another day. How would that be? So with that, I will close unless anyone else has any comments for the panel. The hearing on House Bill 3462.
And thank you very much.
Thank you, Representative Wilkin. And I believe, colleagues, that completes our agenda for the day, and the meeting is adjourned.
We don't even get to open the record.